Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Beiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of The Middle Ground.
And welcome to The Middle Ground. This is Michael Charney. I'm joined somewhat tonight with co-host Eric Beiler. He is, I believe the phrase he used was somewhere between Little Rock and Denver. I assume that's either a train ride or a long drive, perhaps even a flight. I'm not sure, but he will be with us this evening. And although he may fade in and out depending on where his signal is at any given time. So we're going to talk a little bit tonight about a word. I was thinking today that every generation, I think, has a big word that everybody is fascinated by, but nobody really understands. When I was a kid, that word was anti-disestablishmentarianism. To this day, I have no idea what that word means. I do know that if you could spell it, particularly when I was in grade school or middle school, if you could spell it, you could impress other people. Nobody important, because it meant you were sort of a nerd, and the people who were really good at handball or baseball or kickball were the ones who got all the girls. But those of us who could spell anti-disestablishmentarianism, we felt kind of good about ourselves, even if we didn't know what the word meant. I'm convinced that for this generation, that word is going to be sequester, which up until the Budget Control Act of 2011, nobody outside, you know, legal circles had any idea that word even existed. It is nowhere near as fancy as anti-disestablishmentarianism, but it does have sort of a nice chunky sound to it. Sequester, it sounds a little mysterious and a little bit arcane and a little bit legal, a little bit secretive. So I imagine that it will have some staying power over time. Most importantly, I think that it's a word that most people just don't get. They don't really understand what it's all about. They know that it's going on. Although, interestingly, I dug up a phrase today from, I wrote a little bit about this afternoon, and a quote. I was struck by something I had read years ago in Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, which is a conversation between Alice and Humpty Dumpty. And Humpty Dumpty says, "When I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more or less. And the question is," said Alice, "whether you can make words mean so many different things." Humpty Dumpty replies, "The question is, in fact, which is to be master? That's all." And sequester, I believe, is a word that sort of falls into that. It means whatever whoever's talking about it has decided it means. I was convinced up until very recently that if the sequester were going to go into effect the end of this week, as it's supposed to be March 1st, that it would be a disaster. Of course, the reason I believe that, as it turns out, is not necessarily because it's true. It may be. I have no idea anymore. But it certainly is because the fear and panic has been instilled in me by hearing about this over and over again and all of the terrible things that will happen to all of us should this actually happen. In preparation for the show and over the last couple of days, I've been doing more research and finding, frankly, there are just as many people who define the effects of the sequester quite differently and think that it's not going to be that big a deal. And so tonight, we want to talk about that a little bit. I'm hoping people will call in. If you're not completely, completely frustrated with the whole sequester conversation, or even if you are, please call in. If you're frustrated with it, call. You can vent a little bit about it. If you're not overwhelmed by it or you're still fascinated by the topic of the sequester and what might happen, please call in and tell us your thoughts as well. Our number is 646 929 2495. And before I bring Eric on, I just want to share a couple of things that I found today, a couple of articles. A little bit of background, first of all, for those curious about the sequester. The sequester, one of the things that's been running around over the last few days is that this accusation that it was Obama's idea, that the sequester is Obama's fault. Ignore for a moment the idea that fault and idea are somehow equated in that conversation. They're not. But it is true that the idea for the sequester, for what became the Budget Control Act of 2011, did come from the White House. It came, I believe, from the budget director, and it was originally proposed by the White House. It was never intended to be a budget. It was intended only to be scary enough to get people in Congress to actually work together. The those who defend Obama's position on this rightly point out that the reason we got into this in the first place is because there was a hostage crisis, if you will, with the Tea Party caucus in the House after 2010, essentially holding all of us hostage, our economy hostage, in what became the first debt ceiling crisis and now has become known as the sequester crisis. The sequester itself for 2013 is really about roughly $87 billion. Over 10 years, which is the way they do all this budgeting, we're talking about $1.2 trillion, but it's not even over the years. And by the way, side note, I've never really understood why we do these things in 10-year cycles. I mean, I can understand 4-year cycles, the length of a presidency. I can certainly understand 2-year cycles, the length of a Congress. But I don't understand the logic of 10-year cycles unless it's to be able to pretend that we're doing big, big things that we know are all going to be changed anyway 2 or 3 years down the road. Nevertheless, for this year, they're talking about $87 billion. And that breaks down grossly into a bit more than $40 billion in defense cuts, about $29 billion or so in domestic discretionary cuts, about $10 billion in Medicare cuts, and about $4 billion in other programs, other domestic programs, things like national parks, for example, will see some cuts. There are a few other things on the list as well. I had a list here. By state, California, Texas, Virginia, Maryland look like they would be hit the hardest. Not surprisingly, there's a lot of defense work there, and defense is the bulk of this. But we're talking about $87 billion. Here, I've got a few more numbers. The SEC will lose $75 million. Library of Congress, $31 million. The Holocaust Memorial Museum, $2 million, $3 million. FBI, about $500 million, FEMA disaster relief, $375 million. So it's spread out. It's meant to be painful. Now, $85 billion is a really big number. There's no question about it. But when you think about it in terms of GDP, and this is why I've gotten a little bit confused, it represents just about 2.4% of the, not in terms of GDP, of the 2012 budget expenditures, the budget, U.S. budget for 2012, that number, $85 billion, represents a little under 2.4%. Now, in fairness, the only things that can be cut are the discretionary numbers. And so if you kind of set that aside, you say, okay, so how much of the discretionary are they actually cutting here? It's about 6.5% of the total discretionary budget of $1.3-something trillion that the U.S. spent last year. They're looking to cut 6.3%. Now, I went to the supermarket today. I'm over 55. And what that means is I get a discount on Tuesdays at my local Harvest Market, and I'll go there on Tuesdays because that's when I can get a deal. I get 10% off anything except, wine, things like that. But I can buy meat, I buy fish, I can buy fruit and vegetables, whatever, bread, packaged foods, potato chips, 10% off everything. And I'm thinking to myself on the way back from the supermarket, if the supermarket can afford to give me a 10% discount, how can 6% or 2% be that hard to cut or have that big, a dramatic impact on everybody and everything. And maybe that's a really simplistic, I'm sure it's a simplistic way to look at it, but when you think about it in terms of percentages, I'm just having trouble now wondering about what we're worried about, what the panic is all about. And so, you know, with that kind of setup and a little bit of background, kind of let you know where my head is at. I want to bring in Eric now, and I want to get your take on kind of what I've said. I'm not sure where you are with the sequester. Actually, I'm not sure where you are at all. So why don't I first say hello and tell us where you are?
I am in Clayton, New Mexico.
And can I ask why? What's going on in Clayton, New Mexico,
sure,
that makes you want to be there?
Well,
I don't want to slur my, you know, anybody in New Mexico. I'm sure it's a fine place. I'm just some place I've heard of.
I asked the young woman who checked me into this hotel if there's any more to the town than what I had seen in the half mile since the freeway turned into kind of a main street, and she said, no, you've seen it. The reason I'm here is that in Selma, Alabama, in a few days, there's going to be a march that commemorates the famous march to Montgomery, Alabama, for civil rights activists trying to protect voting rights. And actually tomorrow, the same group is going to be at the Supreme Court building as the Supreme Court hears the case challenging the Voting Rights Act. And so Annabelle called me yesterday and said, and I'm driving there, she's flying there, and we should have some good video for you soon.
Oh, that's great. And certainly, I imagine the shows over the next week will discuss that somewhat. I kind of wish, maybe towards the end or depending on where the conversation goes tonight, we can talk a little bit more about that. I'm sure people would be interested in what's happening.
But I'm ready to talk about sequester. I loved your intro.
So you're not bored with it yet?
Oh, no. I mean, it's like it's season three. One of the best political television shows that ever have been produced.
Game of Drones.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts, you know, and I haven't been driving all day, so I was thinking about it a bit. I mean, first, just take the context of the debate. And a tremendous shift in issues like gay rights and immigration in recent years. And I think it's amazing it's shifted since, you know, just, you know, it's only been, what, 4 years, 5 years since not only were the American people afraid to talk about those issues, but our leaders were, especially the Democrats, were afraid to talk about the families or the economic fit of immigration or just the right justice under the law for immigrants and for gays and lesbians. Now, after an election, that's really, really, really changed. So I wonder if there are other issues like climate change, gun control, where we seem to be stymied by industry and the gun manufacturing industry, there may be a day coming soon where a similar change, a similar shift will take place, which brings me to taxes. And that's basically what this fight is about. Taxes, the Norquist sort of approach and those who pay them, have ruled the day in the same way that the anti-immigrant and the anti-social conservatives ruled the day very recently. But now we're starting to see a shift. And we see these episodes, or I should say these seasons of debt ceiling hostage crisis that we're watching on TV, these soap operas are evidence of that shift. The fact that we're talking about it is evidence of that shift. That the American people were cowed by the job narrative for a long time. They didn't use the term until recently, but the basic idea is that the rich are the only ones who create economic growth, and they bestow economic growth on us if we're nice to them, and we don't do things like ask them to follow us. We don't regulate them, in other words. We don't ask them to contribute to our tax base any more than they will. Well, then we had an election, and that also is starting to change. So the elapsing of the Bush tax cuts, at least for the super wealthy, that happened recently, and now there's this fight. The Republicans could win this one. I mean, the sequester could affect, we could have all these budget cuts. I'm not nearly as worried as I was during the One, the debt ceiling hostage crisis was terrifying. Of destroying the global credit market, nobody knew what would happen if the United States defaulted on its debt. So the hostage negotiation, the ransom, is much better than actually going over the debt ceiling cliff. So, you know, this is just, you know, maybe another recession. You know, we've overcome recessions in the past. So I'm not worried about it, but it's just the fact that, whatever you want to call them, you know, Roosevelt, economic royalists, the Republicans called them creators, I think we could say people in the ruling elite, but whatever you call them, that we have decided that it's time to stand up to them, and that the President of the United States into being our spokesperson, that is huge progress. So, I mean, it's this battle, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm optimistic because we're having that battle.
Well, it's interesting how you frame it. By the way, I want to apologize to the listeners. I know we got about 98% of what Eric was saying. It got a little bit of a signal problem. So if you missed a word here or there, but certainly I think enough came through for us to get the gist of it. I do find it interesting, though, that you frame this as a taxes problem. Obviously, the Republicans are framing it as a spending problem, and I think the you know, I'm not gonna put words in your mouth, but we've talked enough that I have a certain level of confidence that you believe it's a bit of both. Not everyone, I think, agrees with that. I think it's at least as much a spending problem as it is a tax problem. And by the way, I'm not going to make distinctions about. I'm not saying that means that the spending problem is domestic programs or things like Medicare or Social Security, the myth around that. I'm saying just in general. And many people who I think believe, as you do, that taxes should go up on either more on the super wealthy or on another level of the wealthy, 1 or 2% levels, would also probably agree, wouldn't you, that there are still places to cut, particularly, you know, in defense, for example?
Right, and we will do that if the sequester goes into effect.
We will, but but even whether or not the sequester goes into effect, isn't that still? I mean, it sounded like what you were saying is that if the you know, version 3 of the hostage crisis goes away. Or if the Democrats and the president in particular stand up and sort of call the bluff this time, if it is a bluff, that would mean more taxes and that would be the way out of this.
Well, I want to talk about spending as well, but the reason why we're gonna see the sequester go into effect, I believe, is that the president has said, you know, that both sides want to cut spending. Both sides want to get the deficit and the debt under control. The Republicans are saying, let's do that only by spending cuts. And President Obama is saying, let's do that with spending cuts and revenue increases. The Republicans are saying, well, we've already done revenue forever. We'll never do it again. And Obama is saying, well, let's refer to the will of the people, which he feels is the election. I'm not sure what the Republicans are referring to when they say the American people don't want any of the things that they voted for a few months ago. But it's about taxes for now. And then once the thing goes into effect, which I think it will, then we'll look at what the spending issue is really about. And that's a whole other thing. I'm sure we'll get into it during the show. But I have something to say about that as well. And it basically has to do with the heuristic value. I think it's going to be a learning experience for us to see these effects go into, these budget cuts go into effect. And I think that all of the economic results will be things that can be reported upon, and we'll learn a lot about. So that's another reason why I'm not as worried. I know it's going to hurt people. But I'm taking a long-term view, and the framing is both the Democrats and the Republicans are saying, if these cuts go into effect, it will be bad. We will lose jobs. Our economy will slow down. They're both saying that. That's a huge shift, right? Because the Republicans normally say the only way to grow the economy is to give all our money to rich people. Now they're saying, no, actually, if we stop spending, if we basically have a shrinking government while we have a growing population, that's an economic slowdown. They're both saying that. Let's see if they're both right, and then we can decide if we want to continue to frame our debates in the way that we have in the past, or maybe in a new way that basically admits, as you said on Saturday, on Thursday, that both sides are Keynesian. Both sides like to spend. They just spend on different things, and they, you know, depending on whether they're in power or not, they will complain about budget deficits. But if they're in power, they're not as worried. If they're out of power, they're super worried.
Right. I'm just not 100% convinced anymore that there's going to be any major kind of impact from this thing. I tell you what, one of the things I learned today, for example, and again, the devil's in the details, right? So apparently the March 1st date is another little bit of artificiality. And it turns out that the current appropriations bills at current spending levels are authorized through March 27th. And so, in fact, there is this, there's a three-week window where we can have yet another Punch and Judy show where people run around screaming dire predictions and everybody starts to freak out when, in fact, nothing actually is even going to start happening until the 27th, even if the law becomes effective. It's only the law that becomes effective on March 1st. It's not the furloughs, which require 30 days of notice. It's not any of the cuts. It's certainly not defense programs that are currently under contract and for which the money has already been appropriated. So I'm just not sure that the sequester is going to do anything except create more theater. And the worst thing that could happen for both parties is that, right? There won't be anybody to blame for anything. So Fox News will figure out who to blame for something. But apart from that, there just won't be that much to blame. So I have to say, I'm kind of morbidly curious at this point, but not afraid. And I'm, a couple weeks ago, I thought, oh, we can't let this thing happen. Apparently, Congress doesn't care, right? They've gone home for the holidays, whatever holiday it might be. I don't know. I saw an interesting thing on Rachel Maddow's show. I don't know if it was last night or the night before last. She was talking about the sequester as well. I don't know if you caught this. When the original debt ceiling crisis hit, they did, I think it was a Pew or Gallup or whatever, did a poll, and 50% of the public, based on this poll, was aware of the situation and was in some way following it, right? And here we are at Act 3, as you point out, or version 3.0, and apparently they just repolled, and the number is now 27%. So half the people who cared about it back when it first happened no longer care. They're not paying attention. They don't. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like it's the little government that cried wolf. It's like, who cares anymore?
Usually the first season is the best season. I have to say the debt ceiling crisis from 2011
for the most
was
dramatic,
the best
anyway.
Season.
The most melodramatic.
Yeah. Then they have to milk it, you know. So at a certain point, it just, you know, or you could call it, you know, movie sequels is another analogy.
Right.
I mean, I'm not even saying it's an analogy. I'm saying it's all one show. This is really, you know, a lot of it is entertainment. This is what I think, if I was scripting it, okay, this is what I think is going to happen next, okay? It goes into effect, and news reporters focus on all of the things that the Obama cabinet members have said are going to happen. So Napolitano is talking about less border control, longer lines when people come into our ports. Ray LaHood was on Meet the Press. I didn't actually see it, but I heard he was talking about things that would happen with transportation. And so reporters will report on all of that. And fingers will be pointed, and we'll basically continue to have this ideological fight over whether or not government spending is one of the things that impacts the economy, or if it's kind of a laissez-faire kind of economic world, and the best thing to do is just not have any regulations, you know, for big industry and not a lot of taxation, and especially loopholes, so that the taxation is optional. for our biggest corporations. Like, those two models are still fighting, but to me, the story is progressing in a way. What I mean is, the story is progressing in a way that's annoying and fascinating at the same time. But the people, I think the people are learning, and the people are progressing in a way that is positive.
Yeah, it is interesting. I'm reminded of earlier in the week, I wrote a blog in which I gave out my Oscar Mayer awards for the greatest performances in political baloney for 2012. And I already think the front runner for the 2013 award for Best Picture is absolutely this Sequester, Sequester 3. Right. We No Longer Care would be the subtitle. It is fascinating, and you know, we shouldn't necessarily make light. We're making light. I'm making light of it a little bit, because I just think it has become so much like a soap opera, and it's become so clear to me that that many people are using this as a way to keep their names and their faces in the spotlight. And of course, the media loves a political crisis. MSNBC and Fox and CNN, and I don't think I've ever seen Wolf Blitzer so excited. Some of these things are just, you know, they've been turned up to a Spinal Tap induced 11, you know, because they can't.
Okay, well, one last thing before we go to callers about that.
Yep.
Is that in addition to selling pharmaceuticals and erectile dysfunction drugs and Depends diapers, those cable news channels are also educating us. And it's not because they're creating good content, but it's because in the social media era, we now have a way of having our own conversation. It's important what happens on Meet the Press or on Fox News, because a lot of people see it. But the reason why we're learning from it is we get to discuss it with each other as the people. We don't have to just be recipients of their media products.
That's very true. That's very true. And I think more of them are hearing that obviously, according to the Gallup poll or whatever the poll was, the media is starting to hear that some of the stuff we're just tired of hearing about. It's interesting. We do have chewed up 30 minutes. I believe you walked around the entire town while we were talking. Is that correct?
No, just trying to find places in the hotel that are.
No, actually, you're coming through perfectly well right now. Let's go to a couple of callers. We've had a few people who've been holding. Again, we're talking about the Sequester, your thoughts about it. We're willing to take thoughts tongue-in-cheek, serious, or anywhere in between tonight, because we're feeling a little bit that way about the Sequester itself. It's serious, and yet somehow we've seen this movie before. Our number again, 646-929-2495 to join Eric Beiler and Michael Charney, myself on the middle ground. We're going to start with area code 954, then we're going to go to area code 620. So just stay right in the queue. Let's start with 954. Welcome to the middle ground. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Neil from Fort Lauderdale. How are you doing?
Good. Hi, Neil. It's nice to hear from you again.
Hi. You know, the real major issue that I have, and I watch, you know, on the news, and it's not that we don't have money. It's the allocation of resources. There is literally, from what I've researched, at least $6.5 trillion that are not being taxed offshore by corporations. A lot of these, I've read that 25% of all corporations are not really taxed. The vast majority of them pay, with all of the loopholes that no one will touch, between 2.5 and around 5% tax. That's really the major issue. And then we have corporate welfare that takes care of big pharma, the oil companies on top of that, as well as everything else. So it really is the allocation of funds. There's plenty of money. It's just basically the money is already in areas and they don't want to touch the plutocracy. Now they're talking about chain CPI, which to me is absolutely not only evil, it basically just taking away food from senior citizens and people on disability. And I just don't see any humanity. I see this manufacturer crisis that is just... where are the jobs? Every jobs bill has been filibustered. That's what the Republicans ran on in 2010. There's no jobs, and people, you know, they said that according to the latest polls also. Only really 27% are following this whole nonsense because it's just this never-ending play, tongue-in-cheek.
that really that the Congress is not working for us. They're working for corporations. They're just very well-paid lobbyists.
I certainly can't disagree with a big chunk of what you've said, Neil. We've talked about it before on this show with respect to what you call the allocation of funds, but I think it's even a little bit broader than that. I forget the name of the mythical snake that eats its own tail, right? But it's become this circular repeating process where big money donates in a way that allows them to have exceptional influence in Congress in order to keep that feeding tube in place. Those people in Congress will support those resources, if you will, and they really are. They're resources to them, and in so doing, write the kinds of laws that benefit them and not necessarily people, right? And it is a feeding frenzy. I mean, it's like sharks in the water, and so much of what is legal today is in fact legal only in the amoral sense, only because it represents laws that were passed. But I think you're completely right about the money, whether it's being spent by the government in special interest ways or whether it's being uncollected by the government because of special interest loopholes, that's absolutely the first place we should be looking for. I think we as an economy, I'm not an economist, I've said this before, but I have to believe that of the various shocks to the system that we would be willing to take, the one that we would be willing to take first is an adjustment to the wage and price systems that would occur if we started taxing corporations and stopped providing corporate welfare. I think that's a social experiment and an economic experiment most people, I think, would be more than willing to take, as opposed to false things like sequestration.
Do you know what really scares me, though, and this doesn't really matter? I mean, just from a humanist perspective, our infrastructure is in trouble. Our bridges, our roads, I'm praying it doesn't happen, but I hope one day that one of these bridges doesn't collapse, and it doesn't matter who it is, Democrat, Republican, Tea Party, and all these innocent people die. Because I'm afraid that all they're going to say is that, oh, we don't have money to create a new bridge. But they're not going to be concerned about the people who are going to die if one of these bridges collapses. Because we desperately need infrastructure in this country.
And
that to me is just basic humanity. That's not really, partisan. I care about people. And I, regardless, I mean, I'm a progressive. I'm a proud progressive, but I care about people. And my grandfather used to always talk about how he had a pension and he worked very hard and he was proud of working for his company. I don't see that anymore. All I see is this endless, incessant greed, that money is basically the church and greed is their altar. And it's just, and then these people, look at you and call themselves Christians, and it infuriates me. Because it doesn't matter how religious you are, basic humanity is being forgotten. That we're basically they're trying to almost create almost like a feudal system from like the 19th century here. Like they're bringing back King George Part Two.
Well, I'm not sure. I want to steer away from religion because I think it's a bit of a side conversation. The idea, I think some of the things, and I don't. If John Cashon happens to be listening, who's a Coffee Party board member, and I'm starting to think of him as my personal historian, I would be really interested in hearing about whether or not things are all that different. I do know, I will say, and these, if we look at the numbers, income gap is as wide as it's ever been since mm-hmm. right before the Great Depression. There's no question about that, and certainly we've moved from a manufacturing economy to a service economy, and even starting to move away from a service economy into a more of a technology economy and a money-making, money for its own sake, sort of money-making economy. But this idea of serfdom and feudalism and the myth of the average American who worked for a company for 30 years and got the pension and everything was great and companies treated them like gold. I have a feeling that, like many things, when we go back to earlier times, that we're in some ways gilding that lily a little bit. And I'd be curious if anybody really knows the history or has studied the history of that time, whether or not things are all that different. I mean, you know, I would submit, Neil, that that yes, the idea of companies that pay pensions, that's gone away. The idea of companies that reward loyalty, that's also gone away. But I would also submit that the reverse is true, and that the mobility, the chosen mobility of employees over the last 30 years, it has changed dramatically. That people are would leave a company, would not be loyal to a company if they saw a shinier company with a bigger salary down the street, particularly if you think about through the tech bubbles and the tremendous technological innovations. Everybody wants to be doing the cool thing. So I don't think it's quite the way a lot of us remember it.
I don't know. I just wish that, you know, I'm a humanist first and a Democrat second, and I just believe that there should be good jobs, living wage jobs. There should be health care. There should be, and we all should be in this together, regardless of partisanship. That's just my
opinion. I agree with you, and I would say I'm a humanist first and a Republican second. I don't think that those two things are necessarily.
No.
I think being a humanist, and there are, I would submit that there are the vast majority of people across any part of the political spectrum would believe those things, but they're not the ones who are necessarily in front of a lot of the microphones or in front of a lot of the TV cameras or frankly getting elected.
Well, that's by design. If it was you and I in the room, we get things done. It's people from the extreme element that always control things. If it was you and I or people like you and I sitting in a room, we'd actually get things done. Things would be different.
Well, I'll give you the credit, Neil, but I'm not going to go so far as to say that I'm uncorruptible.
No one's uncorruptible.
I would like to think that I would be Mr. Smith going to Washington, but I honestly don't know that that would be the case. So anyway, I want to move on to a couple of other calls. I want to get Eric's thoughts on some of this too, particularly the potential economic impact of corporate welfare and stuff. But thanks very much for calling in, Neil. Always good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Eric, I want to bring you back in. Neil and I sort of wound around a few different conversations. But particularly, I know you also agree with respect to, more efficient and fair corporate taxation policies, as well as the elimination of corporate welfare. Have you thought at all about what kind of economic impact or what that would do? Because we hear a lot about we should be doing that instead of, you know, all these other things in the sequester.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard some arguments that sounded, you know, pretty well reasoned, that when you enforce the tax code, and basically you crack down on tax evasion at the corporate level and at the family trust level, that especially the ones that are creating the stuff that we buy, I think maybe even you said this, Michael, they'll pass that cost down to us. So it may end up that we get to balance our budget, but at the same time, we'll pay a little bit more for the goods that we buy, because these people are going to make their money one way or another, either by stiffing the government or by stiffing us. So, I mean, I think that might be true, but just, you know, the anti-immigrant people so often say we're a nation of laws, and we are. If we're a nation of laws, then I think we should ask even the most powerful and most wealthy people to abide by them. So that's what I want to see. I just want to see what happens if they actually pay the tax rate that we set by law.
Well, of course, as Neil and I were talking about, a lot of those laws were created within the context of that, you know, snake circling its own tail, and so those laws may be legal, but there are many of them there that are designed to benefit those people who benefit from them, right? So it may be more than law. I mean, there's no miracle answers, but this need for sort of closing that, I'll use Neil's word, that humanist gap between what's on the books and we know there are lots of laws. I saw a Daily Show piece today about laws that were recently finally overturned or repealed in Virginia. There's a, one of your places you're very fond of, spent a lot of time there. Laws, for example, about not being able to hose down a sidewalk while it's raining or something like that. I mean, just ridiculous. There are laws about everything.
That makes sense, actually. We lost that law.
I'm sure I'm misquoting the law. It was a Daily Show piece, and there's apparently one state legislator in Virginia who has made it his career to go through the old laws that are back from the 19th century and get them off the books. But we're way off on a tangent. It's my fault. But
if the arbiters of who is really a Republican are listening. You just said that you watched The Daily Show and Rachel Maddow last night.
I'm very open about the fact that I want to make sure I get, I'm going to go ahead and use the phrase, a fair and balanced view. You know, it's interesting, we're going off on another tangent, but I gave a lecture last week on politics and media, and one of the things that, one of the people who was in the audience was a retired talk show radio host back from the time when it was much less partisan and, you know, they'd talk about anything. And one of the things he said to me is the reason that the numbers, particularly the ratings numbers, TV and radio ratings, are so different is that the Democrats will watch Fox because they kind of want to get mad. They enjoy getting mad at Fox, was the way he put it. But for whatever reason, they'll watch Fox, and they will have a bit more of an expanded view about what's going on both sides. Whereas the conservatives who watch Fox, the Fox lovers, will never cross over and watch MSNBC.
Right.
Unless they're catching 10 minutes of Joe Scarborough by accident while they're having their coffee, right?
I think it's partly because MSNBC and The Daily Show, and I'm not saying The Daily Show is liberal, but, you know, The Daily Show certainly, I think, mocks Republicans and Fox News more than it does Democrats. But what happens is that those two channels use the Republican media outlets as comedy material, basically. And then that probably sends audience members over there. Whereas on Fox News, if they mention MSNBC, they do it in such a negative way that no one would go and want to watch it.
Yeah. Well, whereas, of course, it's the liberal media.
It's traitorous, really. I mean, it's worse than liberal. It's, you know, it's anti-American, and so who would want to watch that?
Right. Exactly. So, but yes, I do watch, just for the record, I do watch Rachel Maddow now and then. I watch The Daily Show pretty much all the time. It's what I do while I eat lunch. I pick it up cool. on demand from the night before. I have a very tough time with Sean. I really can't watch Sean Hannity anymore. I used to watch him a fair bit. I do watch O'Reilly now and then. The Five, okay, occasionally.
Horrible. Trying to be funny and mean at the same time.
It is. It's a bit of an amusing show. I do enjoy, when I'm done with The Daily Show, I usually catch 10 or 15 minutes of Megyn Kelly at the beginning of her 1 o'clock piece. I can't watch Al Sharpton. If I watch Ed Schultz, it's only after a couple of beers and to laugh. I do like Chris Hayes now and then, and I like Lawrence O'Donnell now and then. I like Piers Morgan, so I spread it around a bit. Anyway, we've got a bunch of callers. Enough about my viewing habits. Although I work from home, I rarely listen to any of the radio pundits anymore. I just catch it all on TV. But let's go ahead and catch a couple more calls. We have Area 620 coming up, then we have 732 in the loop, and then behind that 518. So we'll get to all our callers. We have a bit of time left in the show. We're talking about the sequester tonight on The Middle Ground with Eric Beiler and Michael Cherney. The call-in number, again, is area code 646-929-2495. We're going to go now to area code 620. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
I'm Jack Golding.
Jack, how are you?
Fine.
I believe we talked to you just the other day when I was subbing in on lunch for Loudon.
Yeah, but he's finger-pointing, I think. Who's blaming who? I cannot. I've been mad at that possibility for 18 months, maybe, that's been doing that.
Matt, I'm sorry, at the blaming? Are you mad at the blaming, or are you mad at the sequester coming up?
I have a policy because I do not watch Fox News.
Okay. I'm sure there's a lot of people who agree with you.
I mean, on one hand, I'm intolerant of Tea Party people.
Okay.
Because they just thought, and I say that conservative, okay? We call them conservatives. They're insulting the word conservative. Conservative means slow progress. That's the way I was taught in high school. And this goes back maybe 60 years.
I agree with you. I was taught the same thing, and I believe that now. And I think I mentioned on an earlier show, it might have been on Thursday or it might have been last week.
You're talking about guys. They were. I just watched, it was MSNBC at 4 o'clock. They approved Hagel, finally confirmed Hagel for defense secretary. I was never sure they were going to do that. But thank God.
So let me ask you, Jack, before we go off, Hagel's a little bit of a different topic. What do you think?
I got solutions for all of these problems.
So tell me what you think the way is. Do you think we should let the sequester happen?
No.
Okay, so what would you recommend instead?
I'll tell you why it shouldn't happen, because I do believe what comes out of Obama's mouth and MSNBC and CNN. Because it's going to affect everybody from WIC to WIC to the military. I have a sensible way. The military needs to be reduced, but not the way they plan to do it. They're going to cut out 800,000 civilians in the military. And they're going to...
Well, that's the threat anyway. That's the threat.
Yeah, that's the threat. What else? They're going to... I think it should all fall on the contractors, because they're the ones that's causing the waste in the military. Plenty of waste in the military. And I think Hagel, as an enlisted man, should be able to handle all that. And he may... and there was one carrier supposed to be assigned to the Gulf, and it's not going to go to the Gulf. And Hagel's missed an important meeting in Brussels or New Amsterdam. Other things. Okay, now, Social Security.
Well, let's stick with the military, because Social Security is not part of the sequester. Social Security can't be touched as part of the sequester. So let's stick with the military. I agree with you.
Nor Medicare,
food stamps can't be touched. Medicare isn't being touched. Social Security is not being touched. There's a number of things. There are some domestic poverty programs that will be hit, but and of course education is an issue.
You got to be able to cut down on waste from places like Halliburton, Blackwater.
But I agree with you. I think we all would agree with you. I'm going to go ahead and get Eric's take on this, Jack. But I agree. Thanks, Jack. I appreciate you bringing that up. It's not just the contractors like Blackwater, Eric, but it's also the sort of standard military contractors, the BAEs and the Lockheeds, and these are not evil corporations, right? Just because they're in the military-industrial complex doesn't mean they're bad, but there's no question that and I understand the government is not a business, and a government is certainly not a household, but the basic management of contracts, the basic kind of contract management, where you don't keep paying if you don't get delivered what you're supposed to get delivered, or the contractor participates in the pain of overruns, for example. Um, I I was in business where I worked for several companies that sold large-scale software systems to the government, and not just the U.S. government, to different governments around the world. And in every case where there was some kind of an overrun, there was you know, sitting down and with the particular department that we were dealing with, and figuring out how we both kind of shared in the pain of you know, doing, understanding why it happened and sharing in the pain. I don't think that's common in from what I understand in military contracts with the U.S. government. That probably is a place we could shave quite a bit.
I'm certain we can shave quite a bit. I mean, you mentioned some of the just horrific abuses during the Iraq War. And, I mean, to me, and I've said this before, there's so many of us who pay just a little bit into our federal coffers. It's such an enticing pig trough of money. And what happens is that Americans invest money in lobbying to get their hands on the beef. And the easiest, fastest way to gobble it all up into the hands of a few people with powerful lobbying offices in Washington is to start a war. So, look, I mean, sequester is probably, you know, it's probably going to shave off some of our gross national product, and it's going to hurt some people who are in need. I'm not making light of that. But when else are we going to get 100? What is it? How much? What are we cutting out of military spending? I mean, when else are we going to get that?
I think it's about $47 billion, roughly.
Okay. It's a time of peace, you know. So it's really hard to scare us enough to say, okay, blank check, do the Iraq War off the books, do Afghanistan off the books. We'll just pretend like we don't have the deaths exploding. Just go do your. We're all so scared. We're not in that mode right now, so time to cut the military budget. I don't know if we've asked that. I'm sorry, go ahead, Michael.
No, it's a very good point. I'm going to you're cutting in and out a little bit, Eric, so I just why don't we just go ahead and go to the next caller. The number, by the way, is $42.7 billion that they're looking to cut out of the military, which is just it's roughly half of what's in line for the 2013 sequester. And I think your point's very well taken. The you know, I'd be hard-pressed to say we're at peace. I don't think we can go so far as to say at peace. But historically, we have looked at ways in which we can capitalize on a peace dividend, and it seems like that this is – it's not exactly equivalent, but I think your point's well taken, that this is a time when we could make some changes. If we can get past the jingoism and the xenophobia and the general anti-patriotic patriotism that is driving a lot of that rhetoric right now, I think this is maybe one of the best times for us to be able to attack the military. I agree. Let's go ahead to area code 732, then we'll go to 518. 732, welcome to the Middle Ground with Eric Beiler and Michael Charney. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, it's Bob Weil in Piscataway, New Jersey.
Bob from Piscataway.
How are you doing?
I know Piscataway well. It's a lovely place.
Great. I think that since we're talking about the sequester, that we've kind of proven that supply-side economics, trickle-down economics, and austerity haven't worked throughout our history. There's certainly austerity's not working in Europe. So it seems to me that more government investment in infrastructure, in education, in research will build up the middle class, create a bigger tax base, more revenue, decrease the deficit in the long run, and you know, it's kind of like the basic bargain concept of employers need to take care of their employees well enough so they can afford to be consumers. And if you look at the Walmart market model versus the Costco model, Walmart gives its employees way less, gets way less productivity out of their employees. They stay a lot shorter, and it's all kind of very short term.
Okay, so I have to interrupt you there because it's not this Costco Walmart thing has been floating around. It's not entirely true. The difference in starting salaries between Costco and Walmart is $1 an hour. It's not a big significant difference. Now, it's true that Costco people have better benefits and they're more likely to be full-time employees. And I'm not going to argue that Costco isn't a much better company to work for than Walmart. But it's not a night and day scenario. It's more like a dusk and dawn scenario.
Walmart isn't the total evil giant, I don't think. But I do feel like, I mean, when you come right down to it, I've been asking this question on Facebook and no one's answered me. It seems to me that the 1% could have 90% of twice as big a pie if they were there was less income disparity, as, instead of having 99% of half as big a pie. And I don't understand
I don't think there'd be disagreement on that with you, Bob. I think, you sort of dropped a few things in there, and I want to take a minute and break them apart because I'm glad you brought up words like austerity and trickle down and supply side. They tend to be conflated a bit. So I don't think, by the way, I'm guessing here based on what I've read, but I can't be inside a Paul Ryan's head or a John Boehner's head. While there's no question that there are a lot of people who want to cut spending, who think there's a lot of waste in government, and regardless of where you think that waste is, I don't think I would agree that the Republicans in principle are in favor of austerity at all. I think that's another myth that's out there, that there's anybody who wants austerity. And the idea that saving money or spending less money is necessarily equivalent to austerity, I think, is just an assumption that I haven't seen validated. I believe that the Republicans fundamentally see, and I include myself partly in this, fundamentally see a different way, a different path to get where you're describing, which is a bigger pie for everybody. Now, I'm not saying there aren't people who still don't want 99% of it. I think that's part of the problem. But I don't think the Republicans are saying we need to shrink our economy. We need to hurt everybody. We need to get our house in order, and it's going to be incredibly painful. While there are certainly a few Randians who believe that, I think fundamentally the mainstream Republicans, the traditional Republicans, just think there's a different path to get there.
Let me interrupt.
I agree with you on trickle down. I don't agree with you on supply side. Another point where they're not the same thing. Right?
What do you think about the fact that the GOP is opposed to cutting the subsidies for super profitable industries, oil and gas, pharmaceutical, whatever, and, you know, at the same time, they want to try to cut the budget or cut the deficit a lot less by removing some of the safety blanket, which admittedly there's certainly some unintended consequences. There's some fraud, things that need to be addressed for sure, some disincentivization created by the safety net, and those things need to be addressed. But the idea of the GOP not even considering getting rid of these subsidies, some of the stuff that Liz Warren was talking to Bernanke about, the too big to fail banks basically having whatever in dollars.
In terms of subsidies, I do not think that they are – subsidies are a tool. Okay, I think that the GOP's or anyone's unwillingness to cut subsidies to, for example, the oil and gas industry is a mistake. And I think I view it more as a partisan accident that it happens to be with the Republicans. Let me finish this. I believe it's more of a partisan accident that has developed over the years of sort of a devil's bargain between the GOP and the oil and gas industry and other large corporations. There are places where subsidies make sense. Farm subsidies, for example, not necessarily for Monsanto, but for you know, my friend Roger Noonan in New Boston, New Hampshire. It's a tool that has been misused, and it has become part of that sort of snake eating its own tail system that I think needs to be seriously broken up. So I think we agree there. I believe that there is a loud and vocal part of the GOP, the part that I no longer consider to be Republicans, who are taking this sort of ultra libertarian stance that everybody should stand on their own 2 feet, and if they can't handle it, it's their own problem. That is not a traditional historical Republican viewpoint. And I agree with you on things like infrastructure, but let's not throw all the babies out with all of the bathwater. So, for example, in 2012, Apple, the release of the iPhone 5, and I'm not talking at this point just to you, Bob, but to everybody, the release of the iPhone 5 added half a point to GDP.
Okay? Right.
That is supply-side economics at work. There was nobody went to Apple and said, we really, really need these things. There's this overwhelming demand for something that is a little bit thinner. The truth is the world would have continued to spin on its axis at exactly the same speed. People would have made the same phone calls and been just as happy if Apple had not come out with an iPhone 5.
Not
it didn't
entirely.
Change the universe. But they did. They chose to innovate and created a demand that didn't exist for something that, frankly, a lot of people don't even need but are still willing to buy. That is supply side. And supply side happens every day in every research and development department throughout the country.
Well,
that's different from trickle down. That's different.
But I would argue that if there was less disparity of income, if more people could afford to spend $400 on a new phone, that half a point might have been a point. So
I agree with you
entirely.
I agree with you. You won't get an argument from me about income disparity. You may get an argument from me on mechanisms, and you might get an argument from me on the kinds of disparity. So, for example, I think then I want to move on to the next caller. This has been very interesting. Bob brought up some really good points. We've gotten a little off topic, though, from the sequester. I think the income disparity that comes from the financial community that has tax benefits and breaks on things like investment income and capital gains, and, well, I think there's a place for something there. That kind, the income disparity that comes from people who are manipulating derivatives, I think that's a bad thing. I'm not talking about people being bad or more. I think it's bad for the system. But whether the CEO of a company the CEO of a Coca-Cola, for example, or the CEO of McDonald's should be able to make millions of dollars, I think the free market, those are people who are doing something different. And there are places where people should be people in general should be free to sell their services at the market value for what they can get. I believe that very strongly. I don't believe they should be allowed to play games with the system in a way that makes them incredibly wealthy. And I think those are two different categories of disparity in my mind. And I think if you got rid of the second one and left the first one alone, I have no idea if I'm accurate on this or not. This is totally gut, no fact-based at all. I believe that you would see the kinds of you would see income disparities much more in like historical norms, and not like where we are today, which is fundamentally the same place we were before the Great Depression. So thanks, Bob. Thanks for bringing that. You allowed me to go off on a rant for a couple of different conversations. I want to see if Eric. I want to bring you in on that. You and I have never talked about this before. This sort of idea that there are maybe different classes of income disparity, and some of them are free market and some of them are gamesmanship. And I'm hoping that your phone will hold, because I'd love to get your impression of that before we go to what's probably going to be our last caller tonight.
Well, I heard a conservative Great Britain on NPR today saying that he has a problem with income in general, but he has no problem with inequality. And I think that the word inequality...
I'm sorry, because you dropped out a little bit there. You said income injustice, but not income inequality. Is that what
was
the phrase?
He's okay with income inequality. And he says it's just a natural part of an economic system. And And that made sense to me. I think that progressives are elated with the progress we've made on equality. What I mean is equal justice under the law. And it's a powerful word, but I don't think it's the right word when we talk about the kind of reforms we need to, you know, to rein in Wall Street and to stop them from those manipulations that you just mentioned. And I think you're probably right. The tax code reform that I think we need is just basically to undo the damage that's been done in the last 30 years and just go back to the kind of tax codes that we've had during times when our budget was balanced, for instance, and our economy was strong, for instance. And then the Wall Street reform that we need is to protect ourselves from the kind of collapses that we've seen that are created when there's basically absolute lawlessness on Wall Street. And I think those two things would be, I think those two things would be really advantageous to not just the 99%, but also to the 1% if we could achieve them.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, it's interesting. I wish I had the speechwriter that I consider to have, because basically you were able to quote and summarize in just a few words what I spent 5 minutes talking about, which is this idea that income injustice is a very different class than income inequality, which is basically saying, you know, the rules should be written to be fair for everybody. But given that they're fair, there's still a free market, and some people are going to be more talented at certain things that are going to pay more. I'm never going to make what LeBron James makes for throwing a basketball in a hoop. It's just simply, you know, he and I will always be unequal in terms of our income relative to that particular market, that free market. But there's no injustice in that. Whereas if I somehow game the system so that I was able to play in the NBA and make that kind of money, despite my inabilities, that would be a different story. So let's go. I think we'll take one more caller tonight. We have somebody from, I think, the Syracuse area in area code 518. I'm guessing it's upstate New York. 518, this is the Middle Ground. Welcome. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Yeah, this is Joe Pomponio in Albany, New York. We're close.
Oh, Albany, okay.
Good evening.
Good evening, Joe. How are you?
Pretty good. Show is going real good, and so is the chat line, so I'm kind of split between the two. I've been listening throughout the whole show, and if I could comment on a couple of things, I don't know
Please.
I can solve the sequester. I've reached...
Well, Dale, why did you bother? If you can't solve it, why bother? We've got a few minutes here. I can give you 5 minutes. Just solve it, okay?
I couldn't. I'm dealing with people that don't want to solve it, all right? What they want to do is get on TV and get ready for the next election. This is what this is all about. Now, if I could, we talked earlier about the sequester as a word. Okay, so I got my iMac here, I looked it up, and it had government, okay? And what it is the Graham Rudin Polling's Balanced Budget Act, okay? It goes back to 1985. Budget and Emergency Deficit Control Reaffirmation Act of 1987, Graham Rudin. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this nice thing basically was set up as a way of sequestering, taking from the funds, okay, that we didn't have the money to pay. Now, let me get to the good part. It was overruled by the Supreme Court. I'm trying to find the part.
In 86, yeah.
Right, okay. And then they came out with the
version 2, basically.
Right. Okay. And that's what stands today, the Budget Enforcement Act of 1990. Now, that act does not include Social Security. They are arguing now over Social Security and Medicare. Now, having.
Wait a minute. I want to interrupt you for a second, Joe. I'm a little confused. Maybe you can educate me. My understanding was that the sequester that we're dealing with now is based on the Budget Control Act of 2011, and not the earlier acts from the 80s, the Graham-Rudman holdings. Is your understanding that the current BCA is somehow tied to those earlier laws?
Okay. 2010. Those in summary, status 1999 and congressional actions. Further
review. Yeah,
we don't have time to go into that.
Yeah, I'm showing this as a unique legislative history piece.
Well, they
came in 2011, independent of the earlier Graham-Rudman Hollings stuff.
Then it's something they did in 2011. They made this up themselves.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah, this came out of the White House. This came out of the White House Budget Office.
All right. Now, what, I mean, the reason I have to go to the Comedy Channel on this without going to specific programs, okay, what I'm seeing, and I'm a working guy all my life. I've paid Social Security. I've paid Medicare. I guess unlike most people, and that includes people I work with, they aren't aware that my employer pays a matching amount. And what they're after in reductions is the matching amount. That's how they're going to help the corporations and employers, the people.
Clarify that a little bit for me. The sequester, the matching amount, what kind of matching amount are we talking about?
The matching amount on Social Security and Medicare. The sequester itself, I'm using the wrong term, but it's basic blackmail. Okay? They're going into areas and asking for things that should be handled separately. Social Security and Medicare are paid for by the government, but they're not in a general government fund. In other words,
well, they're not part of the sequester, though, Joe. They're exempt.
No, but they're exempt. Now, in order to avoid the sequester, what they're asking for is cuts in them.
Oh, yes, you're right, you're right.
You see what I'm saying?
To go back to Eric's point much earlier in the show, one of the reasons that the sequester now it seems likely to happen is because Obama, as leader of the Democratic Party, has basically said, "I'm going to stand up and not, you know, I'm going to call the Republicans bluff. I'm not going to back down on social programs, in particular Social Security and Medicare." And Medicaid, so they're not going. The reason the sequester, the Democrats would allow the sequester to go is because they're not willing to negotiate on those things. So it's an interesting question, I think, Joe, about whether or not that is a fair trade, right? There's no question. You're 100% right that the Republican Party feels that it's time to take a serious look at Social Security and Medicare. I believe they are right in that respect. I believe they are wrong in pretending that the Social Security and the budget crisis have something to do with each other. They don't. I think that's been pretty well taken care of, even though the myth is promulgated. But I don't think it's a bad thing to look at those entitlement programs.
I don't either. But everything in its time. Neil brought up some really good.
I'm going to hold you to this. I'm going to go back and ask you to solve the problem. When is the right time, though, right? When you say everything in its time, when is the right time?
You do this over a 10-year period for a reason. They conduct a census of the population over a 10-year period. That's basically how our government set up its accounting, okay? I don't know about the time frame, but the idea goes back to the Roman Empire. Governments don't do things year to year. When is the right time? The right time to establish it would be now. The way to implement it would be over a period of time.
Oh, I completely agree with you. I think everybody would agree with you, except for a very few people, maybe Rand Paul. Everybody would agree with you that nothing should be done by flipping a switch. We never do things that way. But the question is it, and I agree with you, it's time to have that conversation. So the question is, and by the way, I agree it should not be under a hostage situation, but it seems like nobody on the left is really, I've read lots of things on blog sites and Facebook postings and Twitter, and, you know, it's completely off the table. If the Republicans even want to talk about Social Security or Medicare, it's an absolute non-starter, which is fundamentally the equivalent of the Republicans saying if anybody wants to raise taxes, that's a non-starter. I mean, nothing should be a non-starter. So how do you get these people to the table? Is the sequester going to do it, do you think?
Ultimately, okay? Now, the sequester is going to start on the 27th. What I understand from Bloomberg Network and CNBC, the financial areas, it's not going to really become a stranglehold until September.
Yeah, that's what I heard as well, yes.
Which is why I believe this is political grandstanding. Okay, and
that's the only reason? There are so many reasons to believe this is political grandstanding, Joe.
But I mean, if either side decides to sit down, okay, it won't be until everybody's hurting. So what do you think? May, June? You're going to have to come up on the right, on the left, with a meaningful understanding of the reduction in benefits on Social Security. You're going to have to restructure Medicare. Personally, I think what they ought to have is just health care for everybody, and that would eliminate the entire problem. Okay, you could take that right off the board. Social Security, you get more when you pay more. All you have to do is remove the cap. That's all you have to do to fix it. All right? Yes, you're going to have to put controls on the amount you pay out, but we're not in the 90s or the 80s where when you made $100,000, $150,000, you were really, really well off. You make
no, that's very true. I agree with you on that. The cap could easily go up.
You know, our larger incomes, right, are now in a higher area. There may not be as many of them, but yeah, that's the only way you're really going to get it balanced out. Now, on the right, okay, we have to revamp the military budget. You do have to reform taxes. I don't think you should punish people that are well off or corporations, but you have to balance it so they can't game the system. Perhaps tie the unemployment rate to corporations' taxes, and if they're not sending that many jobs overseas, then that rate can come down. If they're sending that many, or if unemployment goes up, now I'm oversimplifying it because it has to be codes in there where a business fails, it fails. You don't punish it.
I've heard that. I kind of want to wind you up. We've got one more caller I want to bring in. I've heard that, and it's a very interesting argument. I would love to see at some point somebody sort of play with the numbers and have an economist really sort of go over it. But this idea of creating this sort of sliding tax incentive based on where the jobs are coming from, I think that's a great idea, Joe. I think the other things that you mentioned also are all, first of all, it's a balanced approach, right? You talk about the right and the left both being willing to come to the table with some of these things. And I think ultimately that is what's going to have to happen. I think there are, you know, the political headwinds are starting to look like they might just, you know, over the next couple of years. I think the 2014 election is going to be really critical. As long as we don't find ourselves reversing course in terms of sort of Tea Party thinking, I really have a lot of optimism for Obama's second term. Joe, I want to thank you very much for the call. We just got a few minutes left. I want to bring in one more caller, and that's I believe it's Greg from Pittsburgh. Area code 724. Is that you, Greg?
Yes, it is, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. Great show.
Thank you very much. You're going to be our last caller tonight. What do you want to pipe in about?
I think I want to pipe in about the sequester and say that it seems as if we're all in agreement that it is in large part political grandstanding. You know, we're being played by both sides. I think most people would, you know, if they step back and look at what each side is saying, it's hard to come away with any other conclusion other than they're using this as leverage to make the other side look bad. That said, I don't think there's ever a good time for people to start losing their jobs, but at the same time, we've got a Defense Department that is larger than the next 15 combined. And none of them
it's outrageous. It's outrageous.
It's absolutely outrageous. And for us to continue this, you know, this 70-year-old jobs program, at some point it does need to begin to come to an end. And I feel bad for the people who will lose their jobs in Virginia and Maryland and Ohio. And frankly, you know, I think when we picture the cuts in defense contractor jobs, we oftentimes think of engineers who are working in nice office buildings and making 95 grand a year designing the next weapon system, when in fact, I suspect that a good deal of these contractors are actually people working in places like the cafeteria and in landscaping. Mm. And I'm not talking about now at this point, you know, upper middle class jobs. We're probably talking about the lower middle class jobs.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point, and I'm embarrassed to say it has not ever occurred to me. And you're absolutely right. I think about my wife spent a number of years working at BAE, and I think about the times I visited there. And yes, I'm thinking about the people in the office buildings and the people with the blueprints and the engineering. And you're right. That's probably not the place where those dollar cuts are going to hit.
And even if it does, those are the people who have the kind of marketable skills that will allow them to potentially transfer into a similar sort of work environment. And
right.
Unfortunately, for the cafeteria worker or the maintenance person, that is also true, but I suspect that they would make much less in the private sector than they would working for the evil government, right? I mean, that's... To me, I think
most of them are not actually working for the government, right? So,
but if they're working
in this case, we're talking about direct government furloughs, yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly. The only other thing I wanted to say, and I wanted to echo what I think it was Joe that was talking about, how to address some of the financial challenges of the earned benefits programs like Social Security. Man, that one is so easy to solve, and that is you take away the cap. Bill Gates pays his Social Security requirements in like the first half hour of the year. I mean, you know, those kinds of imbalances immediately solve that problem, and maybe more if there is simply no cap to what an income earner pays for their FICA taxes. On top of that, I would add one more thing, that Social Security payments in your retirement years should be means tested. If you
completely
are
agree with you.
You do not
completely
get
agree
a
with you.
Dime. You don't get a dime. I don't know where the line is. You have to have some sort of a calculus there that determines on some kind of a diminishing scale. At some point, somebody with 7- and 8-figure net worth at the age of 65 really doesn't need a Social Security check.
Or Medicare. They don't need social programs, right?
Exactly right.
And, you know, I've heard the counter argument, well, they paid in all these years, and so they're entitled, right?
You know what I say to that, Michael? It's a misinterpretation and a complete misunderstanding about what those programs are.
I completely agree with you.
Is not a personal savings account. It is a social contract with the aged of the current day. We make sure that people like my grandparents don't have to live in abject poverty because they have nothing. You know, that's the contract that exists there. that's why I think people get it in their heads that I paid into Social Security, that's my money. And that's why people gravitate towards the idea of privatizing the thing. They think it's their mutual fund that they want to try and maximize their earnings on.
Greg, I know you're a progressive, and I got to tell you, it's refreshing to hear a progressive say that, because I agree with you 100%. It is not money that belongs to me that I've paid in over the years. Yes, the amount that I've paid in is part of the calculus to figure out how much I'm going to get out later, which, by the way, is probably going to exceed what I paid in.
Of course.
But what I pay in today is a tax. It is a tax that funds a program for that part of the social contract. It is a tax that it's not my money. It's a tax that's being used by the government to pay for people who need more than now than they could otherwise have.
And you know, Michael, the only reason that you and I may take out more than we pay in will be if we need it. And that's the means test part of what's missing in Social Security. If you and I do well in our lives, we get to a point where we're ready to now kick back and put our feet up. If we have, again, I don't know what the number would be. This would be one of those things that will make no one happy. But,
right.
You know, I would start off with a discussion around if you get to the age of 65 and you have a net worth of $2 million, you get nothing from Social Security.
Yeah, some number. I'm gonna go ahead and wind you up here, Greg, because we have about 3 minutes left in the show. But I absolutely agree with you. There are easy ways around cap. There are easy ways around means testing that can adjust entitlements and be a very good start. So thanks for calling in, as always, Greg.
My pleasure.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. Eric, I want to give you, we've got about 2 minutes left. Of which you get a minute and I get a minute, right?
Okay.
You can have a minute and a half. I've done most of the talking tonight. Let me just ask a question. Let's assume the sequester goes in Friday. What do you hope happens next week? What do you expect and what do you hope happens next week? In 30 seconds.
Okay. Well, what I expect will happen is that the new defense secretary will be able to make do, and we won't see any drastic effects in terms of our military readiness or national security. Other things in the public sector may actually be made to look really, really bad, and it'll sort of be another kind of political theater, but one that's instructive. And so I think it's going to be something that on the other end of it, we might actually be able to do the infrastructure and education and research and development investment that we want to do, because it'll be a lesson for the American people that this kind of spending actually makes a difference.
Interesting. I have a different view. I see the media going into full-fledged blame mode, about a week of tremendous posturing, and then several weeks of independent, individualized legislation trying to unwind certain pieces of the sequester one item at a time.
Yeah,
while a bunch of stuff goes on behind
closed
doors.
That's not different. Exactly what I expect.
Yeah, you're right. You're probably right.
Yours is one more cynical view,
I guess.
No, I mean, step one is, we learn these lessons, and as we watch Congress try to undo the economic damage of basically premature austerity, and you're right, the word is a loaded word, but we've been from premature austerity since the Tea Party Congress came in 2011, and it's done all of the private sector job growth that we've had because we've had all the public sector cuts, firemen, teachers, police, all of that. So we're just going to continue to have this kind of, private sector job growth, public sector job cut, and we'll move forward, but not as fast as we could. But it won't be the end of the world.
I absolutely agree. It won't be the end of the world either way. I want to thank everyone, all our callers, Jack, Joe, Greg, Bob, another Joe we had, Neil. Hopefully I didn't miss anybody. Thank you for calling in. Great show, a great topic. And, next week we'll have at least some answers to what's going to happen. We'll at least have seen a little bit. We'll have gone through the looking glass, I guess, and seen exactly how Humpty Dumpty is going to define this word. Thank you all for joining us, and we'll look forward to talking to you next week again on The Middle Ground. Good night.
That's our time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at conservatives.coffeepartyusa.com, where you can follow the middle ground and participate in the 99% media. Our theme was written and performed by The Consultants and produced by Van Gabriel. Please join us again next week on The Middle Ground. Until then, be wise, be strong, and be heard.